Hey, welcome back to the Airwave Podcast, a student-led anesthesia podcast for medical students. My name is Peru, and joining me today are my co-hosts Alexa and Grace. And if you haven't guessed already, you know it's going to be a special day when all three of us are together on the air.
Peru, you are right. It is a special day, but not only because all three of us are present, but because we are incredibly lucky to be joined by a very special guest. Today on the podcast, we'll be sitting down with Dr. Dolores McKean, who is the president of the Canadian Anesthesiologists Society.
And I have to say, this episode has been in the works for some time, but I am so excited for it. And here's why. Dr. McKean has been absolutely transformative within the field of anesthesia. And in speaking to her, what you'll see is that her passion for anesthesia as a specialty and her commitment to furthering it in within the realm of research is really, really remarkable. And while we could fill this entire podcast with a list of her accolades, we'll keep it brief. So here it goes. Dr. Dolores McKean completed her anesthesia training at Memorial University of Newfoundland in 1997. She then moved to Nova Scotia in 1999, where she completed a Dalhousie University Obstetric Anesthesia Research Fellowship at the IWK Health Center. And she also obtained her master's in clinical epidemiology. Dr. McKean has been an associate program director and is involved with teaching medical students and residents. She's a Royal College of Anesthesiology Oral Examination Board member, a surveyor of the Residency Accreditation Committee, and she also chairs the Royal College Awards Committee. Dr. McKean is also the chief of the Women's and Obstetric Department of Anesthesia at the IWK Health Center, and she's a professor at Dalhousie University, which I must say so myself is a great university. She's conducted outcomes research in the areas of postoperative pain management, obstetric anesthesia, and translational research around implementation of enhanced recovery after surgery. All to say, Dr. McKean has had an absolutely impressive career, and we are so lucky that she took time out of her incredibly busy schedule to sit down with us for this interview.
You're absolutely right, Alexa. It's always great to have someone with so much experience and advocacy on behalf of this specialty join us. And we're super excited to have her today. I hope you're just as excited about it as I am. So let's get to it. Take a listen to our interview with Dr. McKean.
Dr. McKean, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you, Peru. It's my pleasure to be here. And I'm super excited. I'm just getting into the world of podcasts now. I've been invited to do a couple, and it's super awesome. And I really want to congratulate you three, Peru, Alexa, Grace, being med students at McMaster. Like, I'm sure you have a crazy busy, sort of life and studying. So this is an awesome initiative, and I think it's really novel, and I think it's a really neat way for you guys to connect medical students with our profession. And for that, I'm extremely grateful for what you're doing and for spreading the word about this excellent specialty. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for those kind and frankly undeserving words. But the whole point of this podcast is to get some career exploration for some med students as well. So really glad to have you with us today. Just kind of jumping into some questions. For some of our listeners who might only be starting to discover anesthesia as a specialty, could you maybe speak to what led you to anesthesia and then specifically what led you to obstetrical anesthesia?
All right. Well, I personally think it's the best specialty, but, I am a little biased. I'm really one of these physicians, I guess, who's fairly action orientated. And I've always loved, seeing physiology in motion. And anesthesia is like doing a physiology experiment every day. It's amazing how you can observe in real life, all of the body systems and how they interact and how it keeps people alive. And so for me, the immediacy of seeing results of what you do, you inject a drug and somebody goes unconscious, you take over their airway, you administer a drug, it increases their blood pressure, decreases their heart rate. And so for me, that kind of instant gratification is super cool. And the relationship that you have with the patient is very finite, but it's very intense. So it's not long. You only get to meet them 15, 20 minutes before you put them to sleep, but you have to develop a really intense level of trust and a really solid knowledge and insight into their underlying physiology and pathophysiology. So I think, you know, for that reason, those couple of reasons, anesthesia really interested me. And as well, I have to say, at the end of the day, oftentimes when you go home at 4 or 5 o'clock at night, you don't always have patients that are your patients in the hospital. I was often the type of person that would sort of think about my patients or worry about them when I went home if I was doing a ward rotation. And so for me, that kind of, you know, sort of a very short snapshot worked very well for me in terms of that intense patient relationship. And it's also a relationship that occurs at a very intense time in people's lives. They're nervous. They're having surgery. They could have cancer diagnosis. They could be dying. Or they could be having the happiest day of their life, having a baby. And so that kind of intimate relationship with patients really spoke to me. And then when it came to OB anesthesia, you know, OB anesthesia in anesthesia realms tends to be a fairly high risk subspecialty of anesthesia. And I thrive on that kind of environment, to be honest with you. And as well, OB anesthesia is actually a fairly academic subspecialty within anesthesia. And so, you know, being a researcher, it really allowed me to be able to foster a fantastic research career within that subspecialty. And because, you know, obstetric patients really, you know, we have about a 30% baseline C-section rate. We only are involved in the OR about 30% of the time. So that kind of, it gives you a lot of flexibility to not actually be tied to an OR if you want to get out and do other academic things outside of the OR. So I think those would be perhaps some of the reasons why obstetric anesthesia kind of spoke to me as well. So I guess that would cover it.
Just a quick follow-up to that, actually. Is there a particular reason that obstetrical anesthesia is a little more academic or in sort of academic in nature compared to some of the other subspecialties?
Well, I think to be honest with you, some of it is the fact that you are not always in an OR. So a couple of things. Often obstetrics and gynecology tends to go together. Gynecology patients tend to be a fairly healthy population that if you are doing clinical trials, it allows you to have fairly reasonable access to a patient population that are often amenable to studying. But as well with OB, you know, oftentimes you are on the birth unit. You are not always in the OR. So I think it gives you some flexibility around that. And there are still tons of questions that need to be answered around obstetrical care. And so I think it depends on the environment that you're in. In Halifax, obstetric anesthesia is an extremely academic subspecialty. You know, we have a very small unit, but we have a unit of 10 people. They're almost all OB fellowship trained, and almost all of us have some sort of academic portfolio within our group. Yeah.
Amazing. Thanks for that. Would you mind just telling us a little bit more about your practice at Dalhousie and kind of just how busy the anesthesia service is in Halifax, given the catchment area?
Yeah. So anesthesia in Halifax is a fairly busy subspecialty, I would say. So in Halifax, we probably have about, I would say about 80, 85 anesthesiologists. We do probably 30 or 40,000 procedures a year. So it is a fairly busy specialty. And so we're running easily, you know, 25, 30 ORs a day. And anesthesia care is delivered primarily at 3 tertiary care hospitals. But there are some community hospitals that are associated with Dalhousie as well. I will be honest to say that I think Halifax does have a fairly long day compared to some departments of anesthesia. So our day starts at 7:30 and often doesn't finish till 5. So it can be a long 10-hour day is what I would say. But I don't think that's necessarily typical of most departments of anesthesia. I think most departments would start at 8 and probably finish either at 3 or 4. So it can be busy here.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Especially considering just the sheer number of patients you serve, right?
Yeah. It's a big catchment area. I mean, it's not Toronto, but having said that, we also have just about every subspecialty represented here in Halifax as well. So it's a, you know, we give a lot of just, you know, basic, primary care anesthesia, but we also have tertiary and quaternary anesthesia services here as well. And certainly within OB where I practice, it's high risk tertiary care, obstetric anesthesia, as well as basic primary maternity care.
Amazing. Just kind of changing gears a little bit. It seems like at least over the last couple of years, there's been a ton of innovation happening in anesthesia, everything from, you know, optimizing pain management guidelines to systems level leadership and patient advocacy. In your opinion, what do you think has changed the most in anesthesia since you've started practicing? And really, where's the specialty headed over the next few years?
So I think you're absolutely right. I think those kinds of leadership roles and patient advocacy have absolutely expanded. And we are definitely expanding our footprint outside of the OR. Anesthesia in so many respects can be a fairly technical field, and the fact that we are, you know, intubating, putting in IVs, putting in lines, and we can be very expert clinicians at those kinds of technical things, to be honest with you. But I think, you know, what makes us a profession is actually, or our professionals is actually our roles outside of the OR in some respects. You know, I think that we are expanding our footprint, you know, in the realms of perioperative medicine, which is kind of a new subspecialty of anesthesia. And we know from a clinical care perspective that that's perhaps one of the biggest areas that we can make an impact in patient outcome. And certainly the profession has been very proactive in adopting new technologies, whether or not it's, you know, some artificial intelligence and, you know, target controlled infusions, or around ultrasound technology. So when I started my profession, my training 23 years ago, there was no such thing as ultrasound for either regional anesthesia or central line placements, or even now. I mean, we're actually expanding the use of ultrasound such that we're using it to diagnose, you know, do point of care stuff and diagnosis of, you know, myocardial abnormalities, you know, hypovolemia, even, you know, sort of lung consolidation. So I think that kind of, you know, the specialties, the specialty has been very open and welcoming to technology. Another expansion has been at patient safety. I mean, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, anesthesia in and of itself was actually a cause of patient mortality. So, you know, in the 50s and 60s, anesthesia was actually a cause of 1 in 1,500 deaths. Right now, anesthesia in and of itself is about 1 in 40,000 as the primary cause of death. And with maternal care, you know, in the 50s and 60s, anesthesia actually was the sixth leading cause of maternal mortality, and it's now the 12th leading cause. So we have made huge advances in patient safety and quality, and I think our specialty should be particularly proud of that. And the last thing that I would say in terms of where our specialty is headed, I really think that leadership and social advocacy has definitely been a focus for our profession. You know, people sort of think, oh, well, you know, you're anesthesia, you're in the OR. But in actual fact, we have a fairly big footprint within the hospital. And, you know, we, you know, surgical patients actually take up almost 60% of most hospital budgets. And so anesthesia is fairly uniquely, you know, sort of positioned within the periop realm to have an impact on patients and an impact on social advocacy and social determinants of health, believe it or not. And certainly, you know, there was this comment about doctors staying in their lane. Well, doctors and anesthesiologists really feel that, you know, equity, diversity, and inclusion, physician wellness, and, you know, underrepresentation of minorities and social disparity is a huge advocacy piece. And it definitely is in our lane, is what I would say. So I think those are places that anesthesia is going.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you made a really good point about anesthesia having a big footprint and having a large but, you know, sometimes under-recognized role in the journey of perioperative patient care. And I think that's really important to acknowledge. Just one last question from my end here. What was it like for you to get involved with the CAS, and what kind of inspired you to move up the ladder and eventually leave the organization? What's that been like for you?
So it's been a journey. So I actually joined the CAS in 1997. I was a fifth year resident. And, you know, I would say that that fairly isolated. I trained in Newfoundland. I think I was a little bit isolated from some of the, you know, sort of the national anesthesia community. So I really, in my last year of training, really wanted to meet some, key opinion leaders in anesthesia, meet some researchers in anesthesia. I was doing a master's in clinical epidemiology at the time. We didn't actually have a clinician investigator program. So I actually had to enroll in a separate master's while I was in my fourth and fifth year of residency. And so that was my first meeting that I went to at the CAS. And I was hooked, like hook, line, and sinker. Like I wanted to be involved in this profession that was so academic and, you know, leading research and education. And so, I stayed in with my first faculty appointment. I joined the research advisory committee. And so my initial relationship with the CAS was mostly through the research advisory committee. I sort of worked my ranks up through there. I was the first woman chair of the research advisory committee. And, you know, then I could see where the profession really needed to have, a greater role in advocacy. And that's where I could see that my career was going as well, and representation for, the profession. And so I was very humbled and honored when they approached me to become part of the executive team. So, so I think that, that's how, and I would absolutely advocate for our residents. Like our residents are a critical voice in our society. They are the future of where our profession is going. And, if they're not at the table, we don't know what their concerns are. And, you young guys, you're the innovators, right? Like you are, you keep us fresh and you keep the profession fresh is what I would say. And you're absolutely an important focus of the CAS's membership.
Well, that was great to hear about your journey for your career and your membership with the CAS. And I have to say, one of my great pride and joys is to see that there is a female as the president of the CAS. And even within this podcast, that two out of the three co-hosts are female. And from my understanding, that is quite a change from the initial composition of the practitioners within anesthesia. And what I'm curious is, throughout that career that you described, did anyone ever challenge your competency or make you feel that you were any way inferior to your male peers strictly because you were female? And did you encounter any barriers throughout your leadership with the CAS or generally in your training as a result of that?
So I would say in the clinical realms, no. I don't think anybody has ever sort of looked at me as a woman and being less of a clinician, to be honest with you. Although I would say that there are a lot of barriers for women in medicine. And I would say that there are also a lot of barriers for women in research and in leadership. To be honest with you, I can remember seeing the first female surgeon. I can remember seeing the first elderly female physician that I had ever seen. So I really, really think that from a mentorship and from a supporting women in the specialty and in medicine, that you have to see her to be her. So I would never have thought that I could lead a society like the CAS. I would I was the first female full professor of research in anesthesia in my department. So I would say that from a research perspective, though, I have spent a lot of time being the only woman at the table. And I don't think anybody would have challenged my competency. I do think, though, that women sometimes do have an issue around owning their competency and owning their contribution. And women often do have, imposter syndrome. So I often would look around the table and go, oh, my gosh, am I really here with these big researchers? But I think that I've grown, and I think that that was my own perhaps issue, not necessarily that anybody else at the table made me feel that way. I do think that there are barriers, though, to women within medicine, whether or not it's equity of opportunity, even simple things like scheduling of committees, or being actually offered opportunities. I think that sometimes, and I have had this said to me, oh, well, you have three children, you're too busy, I won't ask you to do this. And I'm like, I think you should ask me if I want to do it. So I do think that there are some barriers there. But I also absolutely think that that is changing. And I think that is changing through, very active processes. I don't think it happens on a very spontaneous sort of way. I think, that there are very granular things that are being done to change that, to change those opportunities. But I also think that a lot of my male colleagues are welcoming of that. And I think that those kinds of perhaps unconscious biases that we all have, just having those frank discussions actually opens people's eyes. And it certainly has opened my eyes about my own biases sometimes. And so developing those allies, developing those mentorships, I think are really critical. And I think certainly within the CAS's portfolio, that has been something that we have definitely had our eyes as a society open to. And we have made very active strides in the past, I would say, 2 to 3 years, to ensure that everything we do as a society has a DEI lens, and not only for our membership, that we represent our membership at the leadership levels and our publication levels and our committee levels, but that we actually represent the patients we serve. Patients have to be able to see themselves in those who care for them, and to have cultural competency and feel safe for the care that they're receiving. So I think that definitely has been somewhat of a challenge for me as a female physician, but also for us as leaders. But I think we're making great strides in those areas for sure.
For sure. It's pretty remarkable in how, in the span of your training career, you said that you went from seeing the first female surgeon to now having such a female presence within the realm of anesthesia, but also now more in leadership positions. Although I am curious, you did mention a little bit of imposter syndrome sometimes when you were at the only female at the table, or just not having that mentorship available to you early on in your career. How did you overcome that? And were there any other obstacles being female or otherwise that you encountered in your career?
So I think that it has taken a fair bit of work and support around that, to be honest with you. I think as you get a little bit older, I think that you also develop some confidence. But I've actually, done a fair bit of leadership training. And I remember when I first heard, sort of women in medicine sort of conferences and leadership training about, being a mid-career woman. And I really kind of thought, I don't want to be treated any differently because I'm a woman. I want to own my competence and own my contributions. But I did end up doing some leadership training specifically for women. And I have to tell you, it was actually very eye-opening for me, because we are very different often in our approach and in how we think as women. And so understanding some of those mindsets, some of the internal barriers and some of the external, sort of barriers, then helps you be able to address them. And so women do, I think differently. And so one of the things that I personally have noted is that I am often reluctant to volunteer for a position or for a job or to put myself forward. But having said that, if someone were to say to me, Dolores, can you do X, Y, or Z, or I think you should do X, Y, or Z. So if I'm invited to that position, I'm like, oh yeah, I can do that. And I can really do that well. But to put myself forward, I think women often don't do that quite as well. So really learning that as a woman, I have to lean into some of those uncomfortable opportunities has been a huge kind of insight for me. And so those kinds of formal leadership courses specifically tailored for women, I think has been a key instrument in me becoming a leader. And the other thing that I've done is executive coaching, and it really gets you to kind of reflect upon your own values, your own skill set. So I'm telling you, one of my biggest recommendations to students, to early career people, is start early. Like, don't think, oh, leadership is not till you get to mid-career or senior career. You know, you need to start that sort of insight and that training and those skills now, because it will stand you in good stead right from the get-go. And communication skills are absolutely critical for the development of your careers. So I would highly advocate everybody start that way earlier than what you actually think that you need to do it. And I think was there a second part to that question?
Just generally, if you did encounter any other obstacles in your career, and if so, how did you go about overcoming them?
No, I think that probably, covers the majority of what I think would be. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer.
And that was definitely good advice that you were saying about engaging in leadership opportunities and taking ownership of what you want to do and realizing that sometimes it's not about waiting for those opportunities to come or to be asked to do something, but that you need to put yourself out there and, you need to be okay with being uncomfortable a little bit in order to learn and to access sometimes those positions, and that there's also a lot of tools out there like the leadership courses and things like that that'll allow you to do that. And I think at the medical student level, we just think of, okay, can I learn like the granular little elements of a specialty? And there's not as much focus on how can I become a communicator? How can I, exert influence on my specialty? So it's really great to hear how you went about doing that.
Yeah. Now, and I highly advocate, being a mentor. Like you people have formal positions, but there are also informal leadership positions that you can have. And you can be a mentor to a medical student. You can be a mentor to, even a high school student or another healthcare provider. So you don't need to have formal positions for being mentors and allies. And the other thing that I would say is that, I personally feel a strong obligation to, for every door that I open for myself, that you leave that door open and that other people follow behind you. And whether or not that's, other women, underrepresented minorities, just people who may not have had the same opportunities that you have had, you absolutely have to, if that door opens for you, you absolutely have to ensure that two or three other people follow behind you, for sure.
Great. And one last question. I couldn't help but notice from your Twitter bio, and you did mention it a little bit earlier, that you are a very proud mom of three. And obviously you have many, many accolades. So what I'm curious is, how do you strike a balance between all of your work commitments, the long days on the obstetrics ward, the research commitments, and still balance the expectations and time commitments that are required of being a mom?
So I won't lie. It's hard. It's challenging. And I think sometimes as a woman, we tend to be fairly hard on ourselves and have fairly high expectations for ourselves. I think as I've gotten older and what I tend to tell other sort of parents and not just women, because you know what, men are very much stepping into very active parenting roles as well. And I think that there are stages in your family life and there are stages in your careers. And, not every stage of your life do you have to be an academic or do you have to be on every committee. There are stages in your family life when you may be needed more at home. And so I really think that each individual has to, and it's not even necessarily children. It could be a partner who needs you. It could be a parent who needs you. And so I really think that you have to, kind of step back, take a little bit of a big picture sort of assessment of what's going on in your life, what's going on in your career. I will say, though, that it absolutely will slow your career a little tiny bit. So I think, I think women may be compared to men or, childless women or colleagues. I think that they potentially, I think that they potentially, if you look at their careers and their productivity, can be a little bit further ahead. But I think, I think that deans and I think that, department heads are recognizing that. And I think they are accommodating that. And I think that we can't feel bad about that. I think that that we just have to acknowledge that you may not, at 45, you may only have 20 publications versus somebody else at 45, whether they're male or whether or not they're childless, they may have 50 publications. And but you will catch up. You will, I think, at some points get there. And I think that you have to have a little bit of empathy that you can't be everything at every stage of your life. And so I think we have to be a little kinder to ourselves. And the other thing is really, I think our partners are needing and are now doing a lot more in terms of stepping to the plate. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean male or female partners. It could be both. But sharing those family responsibilities, sharing those domestic domestic errands and chores and stuff like that. And the third thing is that I think department heads and deans are understanding that there has to be accommodation in terms of, I can't tell you how many meetings I have from 7:30 to, from 5 to 7:30, every night. And so much stuff goes on in people's lives at home, at 5 o'clock. So I think, having those kinds of accommodations is now something that really is moving forward. And so I think that there are so much more abilities and opportunities to balance those now. And I absolutely advocate that people try to just give themselves a little break and say, you know what, for these 2 years, I may be busy elsewhere, but I will catch up is what I would say.
That's really great advice. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to echo everything that Alexa was saying. Your honesty and insights are so valuable. And I think even to our medical student listeners and whoever else may be listening, I think can take a lot from them. So I hate to switch gears to a not as happy topic sometimes, but we all know that COVID has definitely been a trying time and continues still about 9 months later. And we know that anesthesia, just given the nature of the specialty, is considered at high risk given some of the procedures and things like that. So I think I'd love to hear, and I'm sure other people would as well, and how COVID has impacted your role as an anesthesiologist or the specialty in general.
Well, I would say, what has COVID not impacted for anesthesia? Like, it is, it has really been, a pervasive impact. And so, what I would say is that as physicians, we show up to work every day accepting that, some aspects of our jobs do entail risk. And certainly that risk goes up if there's, if there's a war, if there is a, an earthquake or some sort of calamity. And certainly that risk goes up if there's a pandemic. And so I think anesthesiologists are showing up to work every day, I think understanding that they are at the forefront of providing care that's in a risky environment. And so I really think that that has to be acknowledged. One can't ignore it and sweep it under their feet or under the rug. And I think that we have to acknowledge to our colleagues that, yes, that it can be scary, it can be challenging, but that you know, as physicians, as part of our social contract, we do show up and we do that work. I think there's also an obligation for all of our, you know, institutions, our, you know, healthcare systems. And to be honest with you, the patients that we serve also have some responsibility to try to minimize that risk for us as physicians. So whether or not that's providing appropriate levels of PPE, testing, or whether or not, as we'd say in Nova Scotia, stay the blazes home and not put yourself at risk. So I think that absolutely that it has been a challenging year for all physicians, all healthcare providers, and in particularly to anesthesiologists. But we also are very aware of the costs that COVID has had. In the first couple of months of the surge, you know, so much elective surgery was canceled, so much elective care was canceled. And, you know, that has, sort of non-COVID impacts down the road. And, we really are, as a specialty, trying to pivot and trying to ensure that those services are provided, that the elective surgeries do go ahead, the hips do get done. That the open heart surgeries are proceeding so that patients aren't having these secondary adverse effects is what I would say. As a society, we have pivoted. You know, we very quickly went from, you know, things like, you know, having a big annual general meeting to moving that those to online platforms. And as well, one thing that I have to say that I'm very proud of our society doing is really ensuring that our profession felt that they had the adequate knowledge and tools to use to have insights as to what are the impacts of COVID-19 in terms of perioperative management, in terms of airway management, how do we keep ourselves safe? So, you know, very quickly, we developed online webinars that provided Canadian anesthesiologists with all the tools and information and, guidance that they needed to feel that they were able to appropriately provide, patients who are suffering with COVID the appropriate level of care while still protecting themselves. And for that, I'm incredibly proud of not only the CAS, but the members who contributed, the CAS members who contributed to those kinds of educational sessions. And I think that Canadian anesthesiologists really felt incredibly supported during that time period with that kind of educational offering that we were able to very quickly organize for them. So I think that that's been a silver lining. I think another silver lining to COVID that our specialty has realized is that we actually can use virtual platforms and online platforms, to do patient assessments, to do patient care, but as well, to actually educate and to actually do, like, we transformed all of our rounds to Zoom meetings. And that has actually been, a great modality. And the third thing that I would say that has been incredibly enlightening and a silver lining with COVID is that we've actually moved a lot of those 5:30 to 7 meetings online. And so I can actually some days get home and do that meeting at home. And so that actually has been a little bit enlightening, or it's actually been able to improve work-life balance a little bit as well. So I think there have been lots of challenges for COVID, but I think there are actually lots of silver linings as well, is what I would say.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think it's sometimes hard to see those silver linings in the moment, but it definitely seems like it'll come to some fruitful change as well. So maybe just kind of a follow-up. I know you kind of brought up in your role as the CAS president as well. I'd love to hear more about how that's been during a pandemic as well, and kind of what you've been doing to like constantly adapt to changing guidelines and how that's been on your end.
Yeah. So I kind of took over halfway. So Dr. Dan Bainbridge was president right up until August, and then I took over in September. So I think I'm the second wave president. But you know what? It has been one of the things that for a president of a society is really having presence, you know, for people, visible presence, for people to see you, for people to be connected with you, to have those kinds of in-person relationships and communication is what I would say. So I think that has been a little bit challenging. But as I said, we have sort of pivoted to those kinds of virtual online platforms. We also spend a fair bit of time within the president's role communicating with other societies. Communicating with the Australian Society, the New Zealand Society. So it really has opened up some of those, sort of collegial and opportunities to collaborate, to share information, to share wellness strategies, to share those sorts of things. And the other thing that it's provided us with is opportunity to create some position statements. So really, I think that, Canadian anesthesiologists have really appreciated that the CAS has put out position statements on pre-op testing, on appropriate allocation of PPE, on one thing that we're working on now is shielding of physicians. So for physicians who may be at high risk for contracting COVID or complications as a result of COVID, how accommodations can be made. And not only for physicians, so it might be accommodations to clinical work. It may be actually may be withdrawal from call. Actually may be for our learners. You know, how are we going to accommodate our learners getting the appropriate training that they may need? So I think that has been for the start of my presidency, that definitely has been a focus on ensuring that the membership and the Canadian anesthesia community feels supported, that they have the tools and education and the backing of a national specialty society for guidance around those things. So, if they're advocating to their hospital that they want to have pre-op testing, they can point to those guidance documents to say, well, this is what our national society advocates for. So I think that is an extremely valuable tool for them.
Yeah, and I definitely think all the work that the society has done has been so helpful as well. Even can understand like having to adapt as a learner as well. So it's good to hear it's kind of widespread as well. But I can always imagine that change is not the easiest thing. So maybe just our last question before we wrap up. I think a lot of med students always kind of ask this, sometimes of preceptors as well, is if you have any advice for students doing their anesthesia rotations during COVID as well, or any kind of tips to make the most of it while they're there.
So, safety is always the priority, right? And so, we advocate that, if the patient is COVID positive, that the most experienced intubator should be the one doing that. So we really don't want to rob students of those experiences. But I think, particularly in the advent of pre-op testing, that we absolutely should be able to provide a very safe learning environment and with the use of PPE in patients who have tested or screened in negative. As things evolve, that I think that the training opportunities, I think, should still be fairly robust. It's always a good opportunity as well to practice your regional techniques and practice your ultrasound guided regional anesthesia techniques as well. I know it's not always the most, we all love the technical aspects of our specialty, right? The bag mass ventilation, putting the endotracheal tube in. But there are lots of other, you know, good technical aspects, like I said, in terms of neuraxial stuff, in terms of, you know, doing the regional, but even in terms of pre-op assessment, you know, really getting those good history and physical sort of skills. Those are all very, very safe activities. Simulation, if you can do it, again, you know, in a simulated OR environment where we don't have a patient in front of us, you know, those kinds of high fidelity opportunities are still readily available for medical students as well. And I would advocate anesthesia research is also a very good, this might be a very good time to explore some of those avenues as well. So I think there are lots of good learning opportunities for second year medical students for sure.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your insightful answers and for your time today. There's definitely a lot that's changing in the world, and I think our conversation with you really helped explore some of those issues in a lot more detail. And I honestly can't imagine how busy you must be in the middle of clinical work, your leadership with the CAS, and your other responsibilities at work and at home. So truly, thank you so much for your time.
You know, absolutely my pleasure. And I, you know, if there's one thing I am truly passionate about, it is my specialty. You know, I think that the anesthesia care that's provided to our Canadian population is second to none. When you look at, situations around the world where anesthesia providers really are scarce for the population that globally needs perioperative care, I think we are in a relatively good position. And our anesthesia training in Canada is second to none as well. So, all 17 anesthesia training programs in Canada are all excellent. And no matter which residency training program you guys get matched to or choose, you will get the absolute best training, the best clinical training, and often really good research training as well. I think that the specialty is bright. I think there are tons of jobs that are going to be coming up that that you guys will never have, a risk of not having work. And I think that you are going to get excellent clinical and research training in Canada. And so I look forward to being in an OR with one of you guys in the upcoming years for sure.
And it's very exciting to know that the specialty is being led with leadership under someone like you. So that's very reassuring as well. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
You guys are very kind. Thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate the interest and these are great questions. And like I said, look forward to seeing you in an OR near me and also at the next CAS meeting.
That concludes our episode with Dr. McKean. We hope that this episode showed you just how rewarding a career in anesthesia can be, and we hope that Dr. McKean's advice can be useful to any medical student that may be considering anesthesia as a possible career path.
Absolutely. And I can say that in listening to Dr. McKean, I was really inspired once again by her commitment to the specialty and just the general perspective that she has on its future. I have to say, as someone who is currently applying to CARMS for the specialty, it also really makes me excited for what's in store and to know that there's a leader that is so committed to furthering the specialty and to really advocate for all of the members within the society. Now, for the podcast itself, this episode is also special in that it concludes the second series. I know, time flies. And I have to say, I can't be more excited to continue learning and exploring the fundamentals of anesthesia in future episodes and future series. So join us the next time where we cover pharmacology in more detail. We'll also be introducing some new hosts and writers for the podcast in the next series, so stay tuned for that.
Definitely some exciting updates coming over the next few months, so stay tuned for future episodes. As always, keep in touch with us over Twitter and Instagram at Airwave Podcast, where you can message us with any questions or comments. If you want short summaries of our episodes instead of having to listen to all these things, you can also check out our website for show notes where they're all posted. And until next time, keep working hard, stay healthy, stay safe, take some nice deep breaths, and count back from 10.